History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And by now, I think we know they don't have to go untold, right? As long as we're willing to take the initiative and ask a few questions and, of course, invest a little time in listening patiently. We might just end up amazed as long-buried memories come to life once again. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only do we find ourselves entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is 97-year-old World War II Army veteran George Paul of Henderson, Nevada. We're going to hear some of the things he witnessed at the tail end of the war in Europe, as well as some of the interesting projects he worked on after the war and a long career as an engineer for Boeing. But to get things started, we always like to go back to the beginning. An only child in a Greek family in South Chicago in the late 20s and 1930s. What in the world was that like?
Well, it was kind of an interesting life because South Chicago is kind of the only habitable area near the steel mill, which was at the bottom of Lake Michigan. My mother had an uncle who operated a residential hotel. That is, he rented out rooms. We had gone to Greece, my mother and I, because she wanted to visit her family, her mother, and she had a brother and a sister, and they were in the northern part of Greece, and they were originally Greeks who had lived a lifetime in western Turkey, in what they called Asia Minor. They were essentially illiterate, because that was Turkey, of course, and even though they were free to practice their religion and have schooling that the church sponsored, they weren't free as citizens. And so the consequence of that was that the people of her generation around the turn of the century were being conscripted into the Turkish army. And of course they didn't want to be in the Turkish army because it wasn't them. And the net result of that was that many of them were beginning to emigrate, and some of them found their way to the United States. That group included, of course, my mother's uncle, and he wound up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he had a little business of doing what they call a hat cleaning operation. Men used to wear fedoras, as you remember, so on and so forth. And so they got into that business, and then somehow he broke away from that and wound up in South Chicago and had this 12-room hotel. My mother decided to go and visit her people who were in northern Greece, had been relocated from the island of Samos, which is just off the coast of western Turkey there, and so forth. And so they were relocated and were given plots of land, and so they became tobacco farmers. They didn't know anything about raising tobacco, but that's where so-called Turkish tobacco used to be farmed. She wanted to see her family. So she and I, at that time, I was 11 years old. And of course, I had already been in school in the United States. But when I got to Greece, of course, in no school except Greek schools. So I wound up being enrolled in a public school in the village. Now, that was an interesting life for me because it was a brand new way of living. I had to learn another language, obviously. But my father had other plans, and so he wanted to divorce my mother, and so he left us there. And that was pretty rough because we had no income.
So you've gone from Chicago to Greece. You don't know how long you're staying for, but while you're there, your father drops this news on you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, he sued for divorce, and of course, it was uncontestable, so she couldn't afford a lawyer to handle her, and she didn't have any money to speak of because he was sending us a small amount of money per month so we could live there for as visitors. After about 2.5 years, she decided that Hitler was getting a little too active, and he had taken over Poland. It was the news of the century for all the rest of Europe because, well, we were at the tip of the Greek peninsula there, and then the Serbians were next door to us, and they were not necessarily of the Greek political spectrum, so to speak. She borrowed some money. Believe it or not, she borrowed $100 from another, you might say, cousin, third or fourth cousin, something like that. And she came to the United States. She shook the tree and got the Travelers Aid Society to help her. So they climbed on my father's butt and got him to contribute a trip for me to come back. So she left me there. And I had my 13th birthday on the ship coming back from France.
You know, you're saying all this like this is matter of fact, but I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to be a young boy, your father leaves, and then your mother goes back to the States without you and leaves you there by yourself?
Yeah, she left me there with her mother and sister and brother because they had a house. The intent was that she was going to get me to come back to the States, and I knew that was going to be in work because she arranged some of this stuff before she left Greece through the U.S. Embassy. They kind of made things simple for her when she got to New York to be handled because she didn't know English to that extent. She was a doer, and thank God for that, because if it weren't for her, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Well, yeah, and I'm just wondering what it's like, what kinds of things were going through your mind, because it seems like a very uncertain future that you're dealing with. And you spent 2.5 years there, so I'm interested in that perspective too. Like, what were some of the things you saw or experienced or felt in your time there in Greece?
Well, we were located in a village near the northern border between Greece and Bulgaria. And Bulgaria was not necessarily a friendly nation, politically speaking, with the Greeks. And so there was activity in that border area. Of course, it didn't affect me personally, but nevertheless, it was something to consider, and it was worrisome. And that's when my mother got scared and decided, well, we didn't belong there.
Have you ever stopped and thought, and I think you alluded to it a second ago, how different your life had been had you stayed behind and not been able to come to the States then?
I can't begin to tell you what fear that posed, even though politically speaking, I was ignorant. I still have felt the whole population of the village was up and are scared. They didn't know. I mean, they left World War I behind, and here they are facing another war with nowhere to turn to. They're at the end of the peninsula. So, yeah, I was absolutely delighted to leave Greece.
What was that journey like, though? You told us you celebrated your 13th birthday on the ship. That couldn't have been a quick journey, and I'm sure you didn't know what to expect.
Well, let's see. The outstanding European cruise line was Cunard. They were operating boats that they had confiscated from the Germans after World War I. And so I was on one of those. It was called the Berengaria, and it was a large boat in the sense of that period, very close to being a maximum-sized passenger liner. And that took us the better part of a week and a half. We left Cherbourg and wound up in New York. I was alone, of course. I had my own cabin because they made the arrangements through the agents here in the United States. And there were a couple of guys who were Greek citizens who acted as my guardians, and they agreed to do this, just kind of keep an eye on me. I didn't mind it because they were regular guys and closer to my age than my grandparents were. When I got to New York, of course, the Travelers Aid Society took over and housed me and got me clothes. They got rid of all the bugs I had and so on and so forth. They put me on the train and they got me to Chicago. Then my mom was there, and so we moved in. She already lived with her uncle. I just blended right in, and that was our home. So then we lived there at his pleasure, you might say, because he didn't charge. he didn't charge any rent, and we helped him maintain the little hotel and made the beds and painted and would do whatever needed to be done. We just helped him out. Mm-hmm. And then I kept going to school. Yeah, I graduated high school eventually in 1944. And the draft board was good enough to let me finish my high school because, well, they could see that the war in Europe was beginning to be more in favor of the Allies and so on and so on. So they left me be until I just turned 19. And they said, oops, we better put you to work. So off I went.
Well, I want to ask you about something before then, because everyone I've interviewed seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. You're a high school student at the time. What do you remember about that day?
It was horrible. It was just absolutely horrible. I think I cried a little bit. Yeah, all of us, my contemporaries, we didn't know about war. And it was a shock that we were attacked. And we thought that we were impervious to that sort of thing. After all, we're in America. It got better because I think everybody became conscious of the fact that we were Americans, we were good people, and we were on the side of the good.
And do you remember specifically how you got that news? Like what you were doing or how you found out that Imperial Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
It was on the radio, that was our only source of instantaneous news, you might say. We didn't get the newspaper per se, but nevertheless, but it was the talk of the radio, and you can imagine it was what had to be talked about for a week. What we didn't know was the details of the carnage that occurred even to this day. It's amazing that anybody survived in Hawaii. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it could have been a lot worse. So you told us they let you graduate high school, the draft board, before they bring you into the Army. Was there a welcome to the Army moment for you? Was there a rude awakening? What was it like to make that transition from civilian high school student?
It was an awakening of some sort because I'd been an only kid. I had no relatives to speak of, and I lived with my mother, so I was Mama's boy. But on the other hand, I was kind of independent in that my mother and her uncle treated me like I was an ordinary kid. They gave me all the freedom I needed. I didn't have to ask permission to go down the street and play baseball or whatever. I ran my own life, and the consequence of that was that being in an Army environment where we lived with 40, 50 guys in a barracks, kind of looked forward to it. It became a fun thing to be a part of this group of men, and most of us were kids. All of a sudden, it was just, hey, a new family. I loved it.
And what kind of training did you go through? Were there any highlights or things that stand out from your training period?
Well, yes. When I was drafted in the Army, I weighed 160-some pounds because I had kind of an easy job. I was hired as a draftsman at a company that did tank work in South Chicago and so on. So when I went into the Army, I was kind of a fatso, soft and so on. Of course, in basic training, you don't own your body. It belongs to everybody with stripes. And the consequence of that was that when I went home on an emergency leave because my mother's uncle passed away, and I had lost between 30 and 40 pounds, and that was just strictly due to training. We were constantly on walks and runs. Every morning you woke up, you had to go out to calisthenics. So my body changed drastically. When I went on, they didn't recognize me. But that was good.
And how long did it take to get an understanding of what your job was going to be in the Army?
Well, I went through basic training. I think that took us 6 weeks. Then we were culled, and then some of us were identified as being eligible for additional specialized training, again, within the Corps of Engineers. And so I wound up being put into they call it a carpentry school, but it was more than that. We had to learn how to pitch makeshift devices to lift heavy things like bridge components. So we went to a specialized training period of another 6, 7, 8 weeks. I forget exactly. And then from there, I was assigned to the 16th Armored Division in Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, which was one of those fortunate things for me because it was all mechanical stuff. And they kept me as a carpenter, and they assigned me whatever jobs they had identified as being of that MOS.
So what were some of those jobs?
Well, we had to learn how to repair some of the buildings that were tossed up during the early parts of the war, as a matter of fact, to house the huge army that was being put together. But at the same time, we were also being shown how to kill people. And that was probably most of it, hand-to-hand stuff, which didn't appeal to me. But on the other hand, you got to do it. It became a new way to live in a brand new environment that no one really knew what was going to happen. Because, you know, early parts of the war, we weren't exactly number one.
For those of us who didn't live through World War II, it's easy to forget that. We have the lens of history in our favor, but 8 decades ago, things were very uncertain. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 97-year-old George Paul. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.